Well, Chris, welcome to the show. We finally got you on.
Thank you.
And why don't you go ahead and tell our audience a little bit about yourself and why you do what you do.
Well, I'm a movie producer, actually a documentary film producer living in Oklahoma City. I've been in the entertainment and media business for, well, as I think about it now, about 28 years, and lived around the United States. And I moved to Oklahoma City in January of 2003 to work specifically on the pre-production and then eventually writing the screenplay for a feature-length documentary on the Oklahoma City bombing. And we are looking at releasing it, hopefully, by the end of 2009.
Very good. Tell us a little bit about your film.
The film is actually taking a completely different approach, not so much on a conspiracy theory angle, but just presenting the facts as they were presented according to the Justice Department and the FBI, the official story, under quotation marks, and then all of the relevant evidence that was suppressed and so forth. And we're going to try to present it in a perspective of which we can do from a victim's family member standpoint and a survivor standpoint. Both of we've interviewed over 300 individuals from both of those groups over the last, well, let's see here, we're looking at 5 years, and a lot of the documentation that was suppressed by the judge on the both federal trials in Denver. And then, of course, a lot of relevant information that was suppressed on the state level. So we want to present those in a very factual, or objective, and respectful, professional manner, and let the viewer decide. So we figure that a majority of the population out there is intelligent enough to decide what really is the truth and what isn't. And then we want to leave some more avenues open for calling for a first-ever thorough and proper investigation on the case.
Well, that would be refreshing to have a proper and thorough investigation on a lot of cases, I'll tell you.
Yes, sir.
I mean, it's just getting ridiculous. We have our own local problems as well that we're trying to shed some light on. But, yeah, I understand. What made you decide to pick this and do this particular subject matter?
I had worked on four different smaller documentary films, more biographical, when I lived in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, worked for a small production house. And then having come from working in front of the camera as a former actor and print model for, at the time, about 20 years, I decided to go into production. And I really enjoyed that, seeing all of the business aspects of what it takes to make a movie. But this particular case piqued my interest. It was a friend of mine by the name of Jerry Longspaugh. And if you actually Google his name, there will be several hits. It's L-O-N-G-S-P-A-U-G-H, gentleman out of... lives in the north part of Fort Worth. He was the actually the impetus behind it, because he put together a compilation of 2.5 hours of raw footage that was fed up by a satellite uplink from the local affiliates here in Oklahoma City within 15, 20 minutes after the bombing. CNN, the flagship stations of ABC and all the networks out of New York, refused to touch a lot of this. Number one, because it was pretty graphic. Number two, because it really showed a completely different side of the case and what was actually unfolding. And within 4 hours, we found out that the law enforcement authorities decided to suppress a lot of that, and they came out with their own bogus series of explanations of what happened here. But I, at the time I looked at this film, or this footage, it was in early, let's see here, 2001. I had the choice of either pursuing my research, and I was wanting to work on a documentary on the downing of TWA Flight 800, which was shot down over Long Island by the U.S. Navy. It wasn't a center fuel tank explosion. Or to pursue the case here in Oklahoma City. And logistically and cost-wise, it was a lot easier for me to pursue the Oklahoma City case.
Chris, can we just stop you just a second and say this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida. And the views expressed on this program are those of myself and are my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And our guest this evening is Chris Emery, and he's been investigating and working with all around and some like various avenues of the Oklahoma City bombing issue.
Well, thank you for having me on, folks. It's an honor to be here.
Well, and it's an honor for us to have you on.
Absolutely.
So anyway, I decided to pursue the Oklahoma City case, and it's a kind of a litmus test. And I learned this from colleagues of mine that worked in the major markets and making movies, is you really have to set aside 6 months and a certain amount of money to research whatever project you want to work on, and then you find out if it's going to be a credible project or not. So my benchmark was either 6 months or $6,000. And I took the 6 months to look at anything that would support the official account of what happened here, according to the court documents and what the federal government was trying to purvey in the courts and on TV. And I could not find anything that was credible that would support their story. And it was shocking. Number one, it was a complete letdown. And I knew at the time after studying Waco and TW-800 that it really wasn't so much of a surprise. It was a disappointment. That I thought that, son of a gun, they had an opportunity to get it right here. And they, meaning the top decision makers in the FBI and the DOJ, and they refused to do that. It was a classic cover-up from the word go. So that really gave me the impetus to look on the flip side, which some people would say the conspiracy angle of it. Well, the people that I decided to contact first, and really to cut to the chase on this whole thing, was the Oklahoma City Bombing Investigation Committee. And they are comprised of, at the time, a current state representative by the name of Charles Key, a millionaire in the insurance business here in Oklahoma City, a retired Air Force pilot by the name of George Wallace, and a actually survivor from the bombing, V.Z. Lawton. And, in fact, V.Z. and I just got done with an interview here about an hour ago. We're on an internet station from Japan, so we're very honored to be on there. So the story is still alive and well, and it is taking more clarity and more shape as the years go by. As opposed to the other way around, where people just shove it down the memory hole. That's not happening with this case at all. Well, long story short, it was then that I made the commitment, and logistically I had to move here. I had made 14 round trips between Dallas and Oklahoma City within a matter of about a year and a half, and I says, I really have to move here to get the essence of what's going on and to really talk to the people and get their firsthand account of what they've experienced. Some of the folks I've talked to have since passed on. They've moved away. It's an enormous gambit of life experience that they've gone through, whether it be divorce, substance abuse problems, they passed away, or they just literally decided to move out of town to try to forget about this altogether. So it's really been a life-learning experience for me, and probably the most heart-wrenching and the most wide-open subject on a film I've ever decided to work on.
Now, how does the Jesse Trinidu tie into this? And because you have some new information that's kind of been come forth with this, is that correct?
Well, actually, yes. In fact, it's at the encouragement of the brother of Kenny Trinidu, who was the victim here. Jesse Trinidu is an attorney, very accomplished insurance attorney out of Salt Lake City, Utah, and he's been keeping myself and several dozen other people involved with the Oklahoma City case on an email list for several years now. And just to give us the updates on the court documents that have come through, long story short, and you guys give me a cue here when we're going to go on break. I don't want to get too long-winded for you.
We don't take breaks. Was
go ahead.
This is public radio. We are not commercially restrained here.
I'm used to having to go commercial breaks and so forth.
You bet. You know,
so... Anyway, if your listeners want to go ahead and Google the name of Kenneth Trinidu, that's Trentadue, and there's an excellent link on a friend of mine, Alex Jones, who hosts the website Infowars.com. This particular update was dated April 7, 2004, and I think it's one of the best summaries of the case that anybody can read, and it's actually a five-part series, and it walks you through what had happened. Kenny was a... the brother of Jesse Trinidu, but he came through Oklahoma City on August 18th of 1995, which was about 4 months to the day after the bombing occurred. This is a brand new, and if you can picture this, a brand new prison transfer facility by the Bureau of Prisons, a federal establishment. It just recently opened. I think it was open less than a year. And for those who are familiar with the movie that was released about 8 years ago called Con Air, this is actually the tangible location where those inmates would have been flown to, Oklahoma City being logistically the center of the United States. So prisoners from the East Coast, the West Coast, all points in between, literally come through this transfer facility to go back to wherever they're needed to go, whether it be returning out of custody or going into custody. So anyway, long story short, Kenneth Trinidu was brought here because of a parole violation. Now, here's the catch. He was coming back in the United States driving a pickup, and had a unique tattoo, which I believe he was in the Marines, and this particular part of the Marines, these gentlemen that was there, calling sign, so to speak, and bragging rights to have this tattoo on their left arm. It just so happens that Kenneth Tredidu, if you would have stood him next to a gentleman by the name of Richard Lee Guthrie, would have been stunt doubles of each other. They had identical tattoos. They just happened to serve in the military about the same time. Marines drove very similar vehicles, and they were actually, there was an APB out for Richard Lee Guthrie because he was actually one of the several bank robbers that were accomplices to Tim McVeigh in the bombing. But the general public was not told about this because the federal government and the Department of Justice did not want the extra accomplices out. It would have completely torpedoed the official story of the bombing. Long story short, Kenneth Tredidu gets pulled aside, and he was under an assumed name. Brockaway, I believe, was the fictitious name that he used for different bank robberies. That's why he was thrown in prison or jail in the first place. He was out on parole. Anyway, federal authorities at the border brought him in, back into custody, transferred him into Oklahoma City. He was due to go back into jail for about 8 months, but they weren't quite sure where they were going to send him. That was August 18th. He calls his brother Jesse Tredidu in Salt Lake City, his brother being a very good attorney, very well-respected in the Salt Lake City area, and told him the circumstances. His brother gave him words of encouragement. He says, look, this you're only going to be able to be needing to serve about 8 more months on your time, and you'll be out. And both Kenny and Jesse were in very good spirits. As of August 21, I'm looking at the website here just to refresh my memory on all the details. August 21, 1995, Kenny Tredidu was found in a cell, severely beaten, ligature marks on his neck and ankles. He was bound, tied, and beaten on both the heels of his feet, slashed. He was literally beaten to death. And, of course, the Federal Bureau of Prisons authorities, including the warden, said he committed suicide. Completely ludicrous chain of events and explanations on the whole thing. Now, here's so what had happened was that the Bureau of Prisons warden was a female warden, and she looked at the assumed name of Brockaway. There was no family history at all for this particular inmate, being Kenneth Tredidu. Not only did she find out that he had a family, she found out he had a brother that was an accomplished lawyer. And she flipped her lid. She just was like, wait a minute, this is not right. So that's what ensued the cover-up. Since that time, we found out who the two prison guards were in that cell block that would have committed the murder. And I can't divulge it over the air, but actions are being taken to pursue them. And we found out that Jesse Tredidu and his family won a judgment here in Oklahoma City at the federal courthouse. Judge David Leonard, very even-handed, excellent federal judge. And he awarded the family $1.1 million, but the jury did, and he approved the award. The FBI, at that point, pretty much flipped the Tredidu family the middle finger and says, we're never going to pay you. And they walked off, arrogant. I mean, it's just amazing how they treated this family with such utter disrespect. So Jesse, in his whole remedy to this thing and reaction to it, says, all right, I'm going to do an end run. I'm going to file, they're going to compel these folks to give me the documents to find out what happened with my brother, why they're lying about his murder. And he's been at that for 6.5 years in U.S. District Court in Salt Lake City. And this last Thursday, it was dated September 25th, I believe it was last Thursday, the judge finally said, after all of the foot dragging and everything by the FBI and the Department of Justice and the U.S. Attorney's Office in Salt Lake City, he says, that's it. It's already went to the appeals court in Denver. They've approved Mr. Tredidu wanting to get the records. And now this is it. You're at the end of your rope. You're going to approve. I've approved this, and you're going to let Mr. Tredidu get into federal prison in Florence, Colorado. And his objective on this was to interview Terry Nichols, who was a co-conspirator in the Oklahoma City bombing.
Right.
As well as David Paul Hammer, who was actually on the same cell block as McVeigh before McVeigh was executed at Terre Haute, at the transfer facility in Terre Haute, which is in southwest Indiana. But there's the big question is, well, what do these guys have to do with it? And it was both Hammer, who actually revealed in a book called Seekers Worth Dying For, and I have it over here on my bookshelf. It's out of print right now, but I can go ahead and email a link to that book if any of your listeners want. Just email me to okctruth@cox.net. And just put Secrets We're Dying For, and I'll get them a source on the book. David Paul Hammer and Terry Nichols came up with the same deposition and the same information on the a lot of the loose strings and unanswered questions about the Oklahoma City bombing. They've never met each other, which really shows the credibility of their testimony. And they had no chance to correspond. They didn't even meet each other. And Jesse Trinity wants to get them on camera to find out what's really going on. The other's unknown in the Oklahoma City case, and he thinks that will help them, him really kick the doors open and find out what really happened to his brother and why his brother was murdered.
Can I ask a question? I was listening to Alex Jones' interview with this back when it was released back, what, a couple of years ago?
It was in May of 2006. It was with one of the last interviews he had with Jesse, yes.
Right. And shortly after that, Attorney General Gonzalez paid a visit there, did he not?
In Florence, Colorado, or
right.
In Oklahoma City?
And I don't know if it was related or not, but it was just shortly right after that that I'd caught it on the news that he'd gone by there, and I just thought maybe there was a connection, but maybe not. So
you're referring to the federal lockup facility in Florence, Colorado?
Right.
Okay. Wow, I wasn't aware of that. Yeah, we didn't catch that news. We know he's been through Oklahoma City several times to visit. There's a... it's called the Prevention of Memorial Institute for Prevention of Terrorism, which is a federal shill. But yeah, it's he's not well received here in Oklahoma City, and thank the Lord he's not an attorney general anymore. So, but yeah, that is rather suspect why he would be visiting the facility. But I can tell you that Terry was visited by Dana Rohrabacher, very upstanding representative of California, who's really been stepping forward and then going way beyond what he should have gone. To the point of helping us out here. And he visited Terry Nichols at the federal lockup. But the thing of it was, it reminded me of communist China, where you have somebody from the government minding or being in the interview itself. He would not let Terry Nichols, they weren't able to visit in confidence. And the same thing happened with Jesse Trinity, who was hired by Terry Nichols as legal counsel. There was still a person from the FBI there. So there's no such thing as an attorney-client privilege, at least in that particular facility. And it really shows, it raises a lot of suspect questions of why the FBI would be wanting to be in that interview. And it clearly shows they have something to hide.
There's a lot of people around here that would agree with you that, you know, and it's not just our high-ranking law enforcement officials. It's some of the lower ranking law enforcement officials. It's some of our senators and congressmen that have a lot to hide. I'll tell you, it's getting out of hand.
Well, if you would have caught our earlier part of our program, Jay's been kind of going through a situation with our jail, and.
Right.
And so, Jay, you can explain it a little better.
Well, Chris, we had a suicide in our jail on 14 June of this year.
And, this is in your hometown?
Yes, here in Salida, Colorado, Chaffee County.
Okay.
And his name was Bob Eggert. He allegedly strangled himself with a phone cord in a visitation room. They used it as a holding cell because they were so busy they didn't have any place else to put him. He had a 0.284. Is what he blew on the breathalyzer, and it was very close to what he had in his blood alcohol as well. And he allegedly committed suicide in our jail with this phone cord around his neck. And I read the coroner's report, and we made so much noise about this, me and about one other person made so much noise about this that they actually had an independent investigation from another sheriff's department not too far from here, Arapahoe County.
Yes.
Did an independent investigation. And I've read the coroner's report. I've read their report. I've read the newspaper articles. I've read the police reports now. And there's so much ambiguity in the story. I cannot, and I'm not trying to pick a fight, but I cannot see how this man strangled himself or hung himself with a phone cord that's about 20 inches long and sits about 36 inches to 40 inches off the floor.
Well, you know, this is one of the things with the Mr. Is it Kenneth Trinity is his name?
Trinity's
right.
Yes.
Right. I mean, there had been some pictures on the internet of his autopsy. Is that correct?
It's correct, and that's included on the series. Yeah, they're pretty gruesome.
Right, and it would be kind of hard to commit suicide with the condition the body was in.
It's pretty hard to take a club and beat yourself to death.
So here's the when the warden found out that he had family, he had called for an next of kin, and they said, look, you can contact his wife, and he had a little baby son at the time, I believe was less than 2 years old. And that's when the warden really started, her blood pressure just went through the roof. They wanted to cremate the body, and the family said, absolutely not. And that's when Jesse really lowered the boom on him. He says, not only are you going to send the body back, we do not want, we're going to have the autopsy done here in Salt Lake City, which luckily they granted. And that's when they found out the extent and the gruesome level of what had happened to Kenny. And in fact, as Jesse had admitted to us on the phone, at the wake, at the viewing of the body, there was no makeup, and that there were people going outside and getting violently sick. He wanted everybody to know what happened to his brother and that he was lied to. And not as a showboat stunt, but just to let them know that the federal government was going to be held accountable until hell froze over, quote unquote.
Right.
And he had every right to know that.
Well, that's not the only case that ended up being real suspicious that was tied to that investigation. Wasn't there also Terry Yakey? I never get his name right.
Yes, Officer Terrence Yakey, 7-year veteran of the Oklahoma City Police Department. We were very fortunate to have his mother on an interview on our radio show, and I hope you don't mind me if I can just plug it real quick if folks want to go on the archive.
Absolutely.
There.
Go ahead.
It's under We the People Radio Network. It's an internet-based radio network out of Austin, Texas. We broadcast from our small studio here in Oklahoma City, but WTPRN.com, and the show is called Radio Free Oklahoma, and it's once a week from 6 to 8 p.m. Central Time. And I'm looking at my, if you bear with me here, trying to get my schedule for when we had Terry's mom on.
It wasn't too long ago.
Go ahead. I don't want to get into change the subject there, but go ahead.
No, I mean, it wasn't that long ago. It was just, within the last month or something?
I'm looking at, let's see here, we had her on back in July. Already got the September schedule. Actually, we had to reschedule for August because she wasn't able to make the July. I believe it was at the end of August, one of the last shows, weekends in August. But she did a real good interview. And the thing about Terry Yakey was he was the very first police officer on the scene of the crime, the bombing. He was issuing a traffic ticket 4 blocks away next to a Civic Center music hall, got in his patrol car and sped back to the scene of the crime. He brought out 8 people from the bombing that morning, and I met the very first gentleman that he brought out. Worked for the GSA. And here's a catch, folks, if I may just go off on a quick tangent.
Go ahead.
This particular employee was smoking a cigarette 18 feet from the alleged truck bomb by a paper box. It was the USA Today box, coin box. And he was out on break at 9 o'clock in the morning. And he was about ready to go back in. He had to be back at his desk at 5 after. All hell broke loose at 3 minutes after. And he survived. And I met him at the Terry Nichols State Trial in McAllister, Oklahoma. It was during the victim's impact statements before they actually sentenced Terry, in which he ended up getting a federal sentence. It was concurrent with the state one, which is like the federal one. But anyway, this individual was sitting next to me. And during they had a slide that was up on a large screen in the courtroom where the jury could see. And it was a photo of Terry Yakey that was taken by People magazine the morning of the bombing. And it showed him as he was setting down this male employee. I can't mention his name on the air right now, but he still works for the government. And he had shattered his leg in 14 places on the right side. He's holding his left leg, which was shattered 11 places. A fifth of his face was completely gone. Terry's top torso was full of his blood. Another police officer assisting him. And then an attorney, who we recognize, we've since tracked down and talked to, was trying to help offer triage that treatment. He was a paramedic as well as being an attorney. Anyway, Terry's running back to the building, and they catch him, and there's Tom, this male government employee, laying on the ground, and he leaned over to me. I don't know who he was. And he says, if it wasn't for Terry Yakey, I wouldn't be alive today. And I realized who he was. And he told me the most heart-wrenching story for 2 hours. And I thought, wow. And that's what Terry did for almost 4 straight hours, and he hurt his back on the very last victim he brought out. But the thing of it was that what he saw that morning, there was unexploded ordnance, and there was a safe room, which was actually, and I'm not exaggerating, I've since looked at blueprints of the building, that was under the nursery. And the nursery was actually on the second floor of the building. And this particular safe room was reinforced concrete and cinder block, full of C4 and unexploded ordnance. completely illegal to have in a federal building. It should have been in the gun range 10 miles away where the ATF had their gun range. And that was one of the causes of the building collapsing because of that supplemental ordinance that was in there, plus what was on contact charges on the support columns. But Terry saw that, and that was one of the several things he saw the morning of the bombing, that he tried to submit on a 13.5-page report to his commanding officer, Lieutenant John Randall, and she demanded that he cut it down to 1.5 pages, and he refused. And it was from that moment on that he refused to toe the company line on this. And he was killed a year and 3 weeks after the bombing. He was found 32 miles west of downtown Oklahoma City, out on a farm field. And it just so happened to be, get this, leased by the Bureau of Prisons to a private farmer out there. And it was 1.5 miles from the front gate of the federal lockup, the El Reno Federal Penitentiary, where McVeigh was remanded in custody for about 2 months before he was flown to Denver. So the overlap on all of this is just, it's horrific. But it's there. I mean, if you ever come out here, I will take you out and I will show you where he was killed, where he was buried, and where the motel where McVeigh and his aide accomplices stayed from December of 94 to the morning of the bombing. And it's the same motel that, and Muhammad Atta and some of his accomplices came through, and that's no lie. We have documentation to show that. So,
wow.
It just never ends, folks. It's like a really bad dream, and nobody says cut. The film just continues to roll on this thing.
Yeah, I'd forgotten I'd listened to that interview about. That's another story in its own right with the Atta interview that you are interview with the person that had seen Muhammad Atta.
Yeah. Amazing. I don't want to go off on a tangent. I'm sorry if I'm kind of getting missed here.
Right. And we were wanting to go over this information with the that was newly released on with Jesse.
Okay. So yeah, this court case with is fantastic, and hopefully we don't know it. We're still scratching our heads to figure out how the judge is going to compel the FBI, other than contempt charges and throwing them into jail for every day that they don't or they disregard the order. And this could run up in several tens of thousands of dollars that the U.S. Attorney's Office would have to pay, but that's up to the judge to figure out how to levy that.
Right. So do you think that, I mean, what do you really think is going to happen on this?
I think that the FBI will have no choice but to buckle. I mean, they've exhausted every single option they have, and I've talked to other retired attorneys here in Oklahoma City, and one out of Dallas is a good friend of mine. He says, not only at the end of the rope, they have no more. There is no more rope. It's been tossed out. The judge says, forget it. And I can see them. There's certain members of the U.S. Attorney's Office, whoever's in charge of that case from the government side, that are going to go to jail on this, that they will have to pay fines. You can't keep ignoring a judge's order, especially when it went to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals in Denver and then back to the U.S. District Court in Salt Lake City. You start ticking off these judges, they're going to lower the boom on you, regardless of who you are.
Do you have a lot of other people that are interested in investigating this, or is there just a few of you?
There's a core group of about 65 of us here in Oklahoma City, and there's actually several dozen around the country. As I mentioned on the air, I've got about 140 people on my email list, half of whom are media colleagues, and at least half of those are very, very interested in this case still to this day. And that's very heartening to see that. You usually get one or two or five, but, you know, I counted 37 of them that are, you know, always thank me for sending it. And it's like, I'm just a conduit here. I'm not the one doing the hitting the bricks, so to speak. And it's Jesse that we really have to thank for this. He's put everything he's got and then some into it. And it's, you know, the Yakey case, the Trinidad case, and, in fact, Jesse is well aware of what happened to Terry, but it's not his jurisdiction, and he's got his plate full already with cases. He can't take on the Yakey case. We have some other attorneys that are considering it. But I do want to let you know, I approached three attorneys here in Oklahoma City and a former U.S. District Judge who used to sit on the bench at Tulsa about the Yakey case. Nobody wants to touch it because there's too many skeletons in the closet on that case.
We're having a similar problem here with getting people to take cases for civil rights abuses and for illegal incarceration and different things like this, and getting a real comprehensive investigation. I mean, the investigation into this suicide was done by Arapahoe County Sheriff.
Wow.
It's just another sheriff's department. And to me, the opportunity for collusion is always there when you have a peer group investigate yourself, especially when you know all these people.
Sure.
I mean,
there's no objectivity there.
That's right. And I don't know. I read this report, and like I've said before, I'm not a doctor, and I was not in the room when he did it, if he did it. But there was another report that the captain of the jail was choking him in an attempt to subdue him.
Oh, boy.
Okay. Now, then he ends up strangling himself or hanging himself sitting on the floor. So,
doesn't sound.
It just doesn't sound plausible to me. Okay, now I'm not saying, but all of the rumors that have come out of the jail about this incident in its entirety have all proven to be factual, except for the one where Captain Holland was seen by two other men being processed, and I have their names as well, that saw Eggert being choked by Holland in an attempt to subdue him. Now, the same source gave me all of the other clues as to what was going on. Mm-hmm. And they have all been proved factual. So nothing else. I haven't been able to prove whether Eggert was choked or not, but it seems, I'm sure that it was an accident. I'm sure that something happened. If Eggert was choked, that Holland did not intend to kill him, but that something went wrong, and I think it was covered up. Now, I don't know that for a fact. It's just my sense of it.
Well, that level of blood alcohol, I mean, it sounds like the body is going into almost toxic shock as it is, and any slight level of trauma that would just be an adverse effect, and then multiplied how many times?
Well, the local,
because
the local,
amazing,
right? The local coroner said that he should have been taken to detox at the hospital rather than the jail. But in the paper came out today that they didn't know he was intoxicated. Excuse me? All the police reports say he was intoxicated, and they knew it. So yeah. I don't know what happened there, but I'm trying to get to the bottom of it. Now I've found that the sheriff has been investigating me, trying to find something on me, and it's like I've told everybody that I can tell. I will not break the law, and if I go to jail, I will not kill myself. I'll just tell you that up front.
We definitely got it on record here, too, so
yeah,
please do keep us posted on what's going on. You have my email address, and
yes.
Melody has my phone number.
We have a
classic. They're going to lie so many times they won't even be able to keep track of their own lies, and they're going to step on themselves on this one.
Well, and that's the thing. There's so much ambiguity in the stories and what's going on here that in the same report, in the same interview of two different people in the same police report, one person said he was pale, the other one said he was blue in his face. So it's like, which was it? He was either pale or he was blue. He can't be both. Anyway, we have a website, too, that you might want to just check out. We did an interview with a guy by the name of Hans Banks, who was a black young male that was in our jail for 15 months awaiting trial.
What's your website?
It's thevoiceofchaffeycounty.com.
Okay.
And that interview is there. It's two segments. They're about an hour and 50 minutes apiece. But this young man is very articulate. He is very detailed. In his story, and it's really riveting what he went through. I'm so appalled at what that young man went through. I had to apologize to him, and I had nothing to do with it.
What was his alleged crime or his infraction?
He was he allegedly raped a 14-year-old white girl.
Oh, no.
The girl did not complain, and when interviewed, said that he never touched me that way. It was her girlfriend, who was also 14 or so at the time, who said that they were at a party and drinking and whatever, and that she wasn't sure. She told her school counselor that she wasn't sure, but something might have happened, but she's not sure. So he was arrested in Memphis, Tennessee, 3 years almost later, and picked up, spent 2 weeks in a transport bus, shackled, hands, waist,
diesel,
and ankles.
They call that diesel therapy, I guess, is what they
I think they do, yeah. And then he spent 15 months awaiting trial. 15 months. It took the jury less than 30 minutes to find him not guilty, innocent on all charges. 30 minutes.
Wow, what in the world?
No evidence, no DNA evidence, no physical evidence, nothing. But a 14-year-old girl who made this allegation, this accusation, and put this man through a living hell for no good cause. Another man that committed suicide almost on the same day as Mr. Eggert outside the jail was accused by a young girl of sexually abusing her, and his name was Nick Standing Bear. He was a tribal leader in the area, and he was so pursued, so ridiculed, and felt so horrible over the accusation that he eventually committed suicide himself. And that was a suicide. And after he committed suicide, this girl felt so guilty that she admitted to having made the story up and said that it never happened. Now, can you tell me why this girl is not in trouble?
Was she of adult age or underage?
She's a minor.
Oh, boy.
Well, it kind of sounds like that we've got kind of a justice system or court system and kind of run amok.
Well, you know, it's like people like us that are, you know, trying to say, hey, hello, wake up, people, smell the coffee, it's Perkin. That, you know, we are touted as the bad guy, and, you know, we're being investigated, and our underwear drawer is being turned over and shook out, you know, for no good reason. And I don't know. I'll tell you, I'm not going to give it up.
Well, how do you deal with, I mean, do you get a lot of problems with, you know, doing your investigation or any of the other people that are involved? What do you experience?
That was a concern that I had when I was making my multiple trips up here before I moved here. But after a while, Charles Key and I really become good friends, and the other members of the committee were almost like family members. It's amazing. But they said, look, there's enough people in law enforcement that we know of and that have come contacted the committee either directly or indirectly that are really looking out for us. And it's not so much a sense of being cavalier or naive, but I think it's more of a confidence in knowing that, hey, we're just trying to do the right thing. And it would be counterproductive for anybody to try to do anything adverse to us. It would underscore our efforts and really put some legitimacy that they don't want to have us to give us if there was something that would happen to us. And, you know, I'm not a religious guy. I happen to be Christian, but I figure that there's somebody above that's just looking after us. There were so many instances that, I don't know, it's like we're opening up a Pandora's box. It's really hard to put my finger on it, but there's a lot of good that we're trying to do on this, and we could see it come back to us in spades. People that had never wanted to talk to us about this case that will bump into us like at a Walmart or at a basketball game or the state fair and pull us aside and say, thank you for doing what you're doing. And I've gone home, and, you know, here I am a grown man, and I've cried because... Not so much for the, it's I told you so gratification, but it's very heartening to see that what you're doing is actually making at least a little bit of difference in these people's lives. So I hope that answers your question, but we've gone past the point of fear.
I was listening to another great interview, and I think it was with you guys, with Randy and Deborah, Randy Kelton and Deborah Stevens, and it may have had to do with the guy that was on the grand jury with
Hoppy Heidelberg. In fact, we had like 7 interviews in the matter of 5 days. I think it was around the anniversary of the bombing this past April. And Hoppy was on, he was one of 6 people in that particular interview. They were able to get us all in on a big call-in line, so.
That was quite interesting, I mean, because he was somebody that just kind of stepped forward and made a huge difference.
Hoppy's a salt of the earth. He's an incredible individual. And if I were to be told that I had 1 week to live, I kid you not, folks, I say this from the bottom of my heart, I would be grateful for what I've done up to this point in my life, just knowing that I've met these people and to see what they've gone through. They've really taught me how to respect life, how to appreciate things. And my adversity and what, you know, the bad things that happened to me over life pale in comparison to what happened to them, just on this case alone. So there are certain people in your life that step into it that are angels or whatever you want to call them, depending on what faith you follow. But there are several dozen here in Oklahoma City and that have stepped forward. And I am very blessed to have known them and to know them and have them as good friends. Hoppy's one of them.
Well, you know, God wasn't sleeping, and he's still not sleeping at the switch. And he puts things on the hearts of man to do what, you know, he calls them to do. And some people can say, yeah, I'll do that. And some people can say, meh, I don't want to.
Exactly. That's why I respect what you guys are doing at the public radio. This is your listeners are blessed every time you come on the air, because at least you're trying to light the torch, so to speak. And even if it is for a couple hours or how long your show is per night, but...
Well, you know, my goal is to bring out the truth, whatever the truth is.
You're inspiring others to step forward, whatever age they are, It's,
well, yeah,
you know,
I mean,
go ahead.
You know, you mentioned the fact that, you know, people walk up to you in a Walmart.
Mm.
You know, people come to me and one of my friends, John White, and because this is also his show as well, but he's on vacation. He's listening, I'm sure. Hi, John.
Hey, John.
People have been coming up to him for a longer period. He's been in the Valley longer than I have. He ran for sheriff in the 2006 election, and that was another debacle, but that's another story. People have been coming up. That's why he ran for sheriff, is because so many people, when he announced that he was going to run, he would be talking to somebody on the phone telling him a story of what had happened to him, and his voicemail would literally fill up during that conversation. I mean, people were coming out of the woodwork to tell him stories. Now that I've gone public and have been beating these issues up quite a bit, people are coming out of the woodwork and telling me lots of things. They're literally vomiting things that have happened to them, the stories that have been held inside for so long. They come out and they just dump it on you because they finally have found somebody they feel that will listen and can maybe help them or give them some closure to what has happened to them and how their life has been destroyed falsely or by being falsely accused of something they did not do.
That's amazing.
It is amazing. And or that the punishment way outweighed the crime, just was way out there. We've had a guy that tickled a little girl, just tickled her. He knew her. He knew her family. She was in his store all the time. He knew this child for quite some time. And she was kind of a neglected child. She didn't get much attention at home. Her parents were kind of neglected toward her. And she would go over there and play in his store. And they got to be good friends. And one day he was just tickling her, just tickling her outside of her clothes, you know, just up and down her ribs. She's laughing and carrying on. And some woman saw that. And to make a long story short, he spent 2 years in our jail and now he's a registered sex offender for tickling somebody. And the interview of the woman who complained said that's what she saw. And what she described was in no way, in any way, shape, or form, sexually oriented. It just was not there. And yet they made a case out of this. He represented himself because he had too much money to get the public defender and too little money to hire a real attorney, so he figured, hey, I'm innocent, I'll represent myself, what's the big deal? And they put him in our jail for 2 years, and he has not been allowed to come on this radio station or any other radio station and tell his story for himself.
Wow.
Not allowed.
Who's restricting the station manager or the authorities?
The authorities are restricting him from coming on the radio because they're afraid that will just reignite the feelings of his victims, plural, not singular, his victims, which there is no evidence or any other cases pending on him of more than this one incident. And they do not even live in this valley anymore. They've moved to California. So there's no reason for him not to come on this show and tell his story. He was denied dental treatment. The other gentleman that, if you listen to our go to our website and listen to the Banks interview, he was denied dental treatment. He broke a tooth eating a taco salad in our jail by biting a rock that was in his salad. He broke a tooth, and he was 3 months without medical attention for that tooth. And when he went to the dentist was appalled that he had waited so long to come see him, not realizing that he had been incarcerated when they brought him. This is how long before, 3 months, when he broke that tooth, the dentist couldn't believe it.
Wow.
So when you hear this story of what happened to this young man, it's a movie in and of itself that I would pay money to go see, and it's a book. I'm telling you, if this kid he's a nice kid, he's black, and he's also gay, but he is just a great kid. He's very articulate, very detail-oriented, I mean right down to the day, time, and event of everything that happened to him. And how he was treated was just way beyond the pale of how you would treat anyone. Very unprofessional, both in Tennessee and here. And I felt so bad for this kid, I couldn't believe it.
Is he able to get back on his feet, or has he returned to Memphis?
He has returned to Tennessee. He's living at home. When they released him, he got the clothes he was wearing and his belongings, but none of his money. They put him out on the street and said, there you go, see ya. And if it wasn't for friends that he had made in this community to put him up, they took a collection, got him enough money, to get him home, he would still be on the street. But he made it home, and he's doing okay, except that he's not able to find a job because when his resume has a 15-month, 16-month gap in it, they're like, where were you? And this kid is so honest, he tells them where he was and why he was, and he can't get a job. So I tell you, I just, what goes, and you know, it's just not here. It's in a lot of places. It's everywhere. It's big cover-ups. It's little cover-ups. And we've been trying to get the media to come in here from outside to investigate some of these things, and they won't touch it. Voter fraud that we believe occurred in 06, no one will touch it.
Oh, yeah.
No one will touch it. They don't want to hear it. They don't want to know that it's so easy to throw an election. And I've had witnesses tell me they were in the room when the memory cards were changed in the electronic voting machines halfway through the count.
That's a big issue, and my friends in Austin, it's a vote count, and they've got vote rescue. You're right. I mean, if we can't even do the hand ballots, we're really in the tank on this one. I didn't even want to watch the debate tonight. I'm a little off topic here, but it's all a dog and pony show. And I'm not trying to be cynical, but you look at this thing, you know, even from the media and the TV standpoint, it's all show. Wolf Blitzer, I know of his conduct and how he handled himself here in Oklahoma City. CNN had their own bureau here for 90 days during the bombing, and I heard a lot of stories of how he treated the people. And to see him on the screen now, it's like, why is this guy still on TV? He's a disgrace to the business. It's unbelievable.
Yep, he is, and so are so many others. And, you know, it takes people like yourself and like John and I and Melody and others. She has a program on Tuesday nights called Truth Quest.
Yeah,
yes.
I've had him on.
So, okay. So
Chris and Andrew and Holland on.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're trying to beat that drum, and we're trying to tell people to wake up and
start asking questions.
You know, they used to say in the 60s, anti-disestablishmentarianism, question authority, you know, when you were growing up.
Sure.
And those kids were all considered radicals and way out there, you know, and all of that. But, you know, if you think about it, if done properly, it's not a bad philosophy. You need to question authority. Don't just believe what you're told because somebody says so. Saying earlier, you need to know what you believe and why you believe what you believe. Not because somebody fed it to you, somebody raised you that way, or somebody told you that this is, you know, the way life is. I mean, I did a job for a family one time, and they were from South Africa. They were Indian by descent. And he asked me what religion I was. I said, I'm not a religion. I'm a born-again believer in the Lord Jesus Christ as my personal Lord and Savior. And I said, and you? And he said, I'm a Muslim. I said, great. Why are you a Muslim? He said, well, my folks are Muslim. I said, you know, that's the worst answer I've ever heard for being a religion of any kind. He goes, what do you mean? He said, just because your folks are Muslim does not mean you should be Muslim. He says, what do you mean? I said, have you ever read the Quran? He said, yeah, kind of. I said, well, then you need to read the Quran and decide for yourself whether you believe what it says and whether you accept its principles or not for you.
That's right.
And so that's been my philosophy, and that's what I tell everybody. Know what you believe and why you believe it. If you have a question, you hear about voter fraud in this country, you may not think it's happening here, but it happens everywhere. You need to find out, what can I do to prevent that from happening in my neighborhood? What can I do to prevent that from happening in my state? Get active. Get involved. Don't sit there at home, watch the debates, and complain. Don't sit at home and watch, you know, the news and complain. If you can't add to the solution, then just shut up. If you don't vote, you can't complain. But you got to make sure your votes count. Okay?
That's the hardest part.
But, I mean, that's the thing, though. It's your responsibility. Right. It's our responsibility to make sure that our vote is counted.
Now, what do you expect to be able to come out of this with Jesse Trenadu? I mean, as far as, I mean, not just this one, but your whole work with the Oklahoma City investigation.
Yeah, what do you expect the outcome to be on this?
We just want to do what we can in our meager way, so to speak, and it's actually turning out to be not so meager anymore. But we want to try to correct the official record of what happened here, if not for anything else. We realize we're not, you know, I'm in my late 40s right now. I'm not going to be here forever. But I don't want my nieces and my little nephews to remember this story in a lie. And this was something that a friend of mine lived in Albuquerque for a year. She says, why would anybody choose to remember the deaths of these people in a lie? And it was such a pointed question, and it's like, wow, that is a loaded question. And that's exactly what we're doing. The just a case in point, the Memorial Museum, which is less than 10 blocks from where I live, across the street from Ground Zero, where Oklahoma City bombing occurred, they spend $3.2 million a year, and this was as of 2 years ago when I saw their financial report, just to perpetuate and pander a series of lies about this case. I can't, that is completely atrocious. How can anybody wake up in the morning and say, you know what, this is okay, I'm going to work and I'm going to not only lie to the public, but I'm going to charge them admission and lie to them. I know this sounds altruistic, but that's the principle of it all. We're not going to remember the deaths of these people in a lie. And that's the same thing for Jesse and Terry. And it just so happens that their deaths are intertwined, intentionally or unintentionally, it is. They're a very important part of this piece of U.S. history. So I guess that's my answer in some small part.
And so with your radio program, is this what your intent is? That is to particularly stay with the Oklahoma City situation, or do you branch out some and look at some
other actually issues? We try to branch out, and if you get on the WTPRN.com website and go under broadcasters and scroll down about halfway down the page, it really gives you a background of why the three of us came together. We deal with a lot of issues. In fact, this last interview, it was with a gentleman, Mark Lerner, from Missouri, who's dealing with the biometric and the Real ID tag and that whole issue. He's been seven different states in the last 2 weeks working with representatives from these different states' legislatures in the Senate and the House, and to try to strike down those particular measures. It's all federal mandate, which is completely bogus. And then they're copping the bill on the states. Anyway, that's one issue. Then we deal with some of the legitimate sides of the paranormal research. And then there are some times where we'll have a show dealing with the bombing itself, but that's mainly around the anniversary. We deal with, just like I said, vote issues. So we try to make it both local as well as national. And then working with folks like you, we have other radio hosts, show hosts on to share their perspective of what's going on. So we try to cover a wide variety of topics.
Very good.
So as far as, you got into the, what was the outcome that you felt came out of the Flight 800?
Oh, wow.
That's a whole other subject.
We had three of their, three of their main researchers and then an attorney of record for the case, representing a retired United Airlines pilot by the name of Ray Lahr, RayLahr.com is his website. And we found out that there were two scenarios, not including, of course, the center fuel tank explosion. That's completely bogus. It was just made up of a whole cloth lie. We found out that, which is the most plausible scenario, is that the United States Navy actually shot that plane down by accident. TWA-800 was outbound from JFK going to De Gaulle Airport in Paris. It was going to be an overnight flight. And it was shot down about 18 minutes after takeoff, cruising at about 430 miles an hour, climbing up to about 18,000 feet. And it breached the security perimeter of within this particular area where the U.S. Navy was doing secret exercises. Submarines were shooting off drones and then shooting them down. Well, and the air traffic control out of Boston caught this whole thing on tape. And as soon as the plane was shot, you saw these vessels, submarines and surface vessels, scatter from the scene of the crime. As opposed to search and rescue, they left in earnest. And it was the private craft and the fishing boats off the coast that came and actually helped with the search and rescue, and then eventually the Coast Guard arrived. But it was an accidental shootdown, and the U.S. government did not want to admit it.
They should have admitted it.
It's horrendous.
They should have admitted it. They should have rendered aid to those people and said, oh, my gosh, look what we've done. We're so sorry.
Yeah. Everybody was killed. They figure they died before they even hit the ocean. But and it was my ex-wife was actually working for TWA at the time when we were dating, and she came home one day, and she knew I was working on the case. This is before I decided to take on Oklahoma City. And it was her station manager that threatened her job. She'd been with him for 12 years at the time, and they knew I was working on the case, and they got the directive from, get this, the International Association of Machinists, which is the union that represented everybody except the pilots and the flight attendants with TWA. And they were Democratic Party supporters. They shelled out several hundred thousand dollars to support the Clinton re-election campaign. And that was in 96. He was up for re-election in November. they were told in no uncertain terms to back off. And there was a whole group of employees, TW employees, that were screaming for, demanding a congressional investigation on this. And they said, no frickin' way, we're not touching this thing.
Unbelievable.
So, I mean, for it to trickle down and then to have her job threatened, and I'm just an independent investigator, that's how touchy that subject was. So anybody listening to this thing, we have proof positive, both on air traffic control radar tapes, the physical evidence of the Calverton hangar, experts that are lining up. I mean, rear admirals from the Navy to professional and commercial, military and commercial pilots, that plane was shot down. And don't make no mistake about it.
We'll have to have you back up again for some of these other investigations you've been in.
Yes, we will. Might have to have you help us with some of our own, as it turns out.
You know what, folks, what I'll be able to do, I don't want to be claimed to be the expert on any of these. I can go ahead and give you the names and phone numbers of, if you want, the folks that really dug their teeth into it. And they're the ones that I've learned from. And
uh-huh.
I'm just, you know, I will be more than happy to forward them, because they do need to get their word out.
Okay.
And make excellent subjects in, for your future shows.
That'd be great. We'd appreciate that very much.
You're welcome.
Well, we really appreciate you hanging in there with, because come to find out it was a mute button.
Oh, okay.
On the microphone.
There you go. Don't feel bad. We've had our share of technical ups and downs on our show. Part of the deal, folks.
Yes. Melody has about 4 bald spots now for trying to get that to work, I'll tell you. Oh, my goodness. Well, Chris, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate your time and your efforts, and keep up the good work. And I am absolutely looking forward to seeing your film and the outcome of this, and to keep track of it. And I'm sure we'll have you on again.
Thank you. I look forward to it, and we'd love to have you on our show. We are booking for December. I'm going to, actually, Melody, I think you and I talked. I'd like to get you up, and if your co-host would like to join you, that's more than, we'd be more than happy to have you on.
That'd be great. I appreciate that.
You folks have a great evening.
All right, you too. Thanks very much.
Okay.
Good night.